Hey everybody, Brian McClanahan here. The woke madness in history education is off the rails. Well, how do we change it? McClanahanacademy.com. And because you listen to this podcast, if you use the coupon code PODCAST at checkout, you get 25% off every day, all day, 365 days a year on every class at McClanahanacademy.com. So go to McClanahanacademy.com, use coupon code PODCAST at checkout, and get a real history education at 25% off. If you like this podcast and you want it without advertisements, head over to patreon.com and become a member of the Brian McClanahan Show. For $10 a month, you get all the podcasts ad-free, including video, and you also get a special Q&A podcast. I'm only going to answer your questions, your listener-generated episodes, through those Q&A. So, head over to patreon.com. Get this podcast ad-free, no ads, not even things like this, and you really do help support the Brian McClanahan Show with really cool stuff on the back end. Get the book that Kevin Gutzman called the single best volume on original intent ever written, My Founding Fathers' Guide to the Constitution. It is the book. When people ask me what's my favorite, that's the one. Pick it up wherever books are sold online and get a real education on the Constitution. Midwits, the Constitution and Secession, Part 2 this week. The New York Times has made its opinion on secession and the Constitution. I'll talk about that on this episode of the Brian McClanahan Show.
It's time to think locally and act locally. Welcome to the Brian McClanahan Show.
Welcome back to the Brian McClanahan Show. Glad to be back on the program. Very glad to be here. Well, I talk a lot about Jamel Bowie on this show. He writes for the New York Times, and most of the time he has Trump derangement syndrome. He focuses a lot on that, or on the Republican Party and how it's really just a party of, I don't know, racism, John C. Calhoun, the Confederacy, whatever it is. He spends a lot of time with that. Every now and then, I'll give Bowie credit, he gets something right. And in fact, the headline on this piece on Nikki Haley and secession is 100% correct. It's 100% correct, but the devil's in the details and how he goes about arguing his position. So, as you might imagine, this particular topic is secession. Now, I've done this a lot recently, and anytime you have a candidate for president talk about secession, it's going to be big news. And I know this happened a couple of weeks ago, but still, it's big news, and it takes me a little time to filter through these things. So I want to focus on this Jamel Bowie piece because, look, if we're going to think locally and act locally, if we're going to start talking about the local, federalism, bottom-up government, these kind of things need to be discussed. We need to talk about decentralization in every form, whether it's federalism, nullification, secession, it really doesn't matter. We have to talk about that. We have to talk about decentralization even at the state level. What kind of powers can the counties have compared to the state? When you look at the state that I live in, it's the same size population-wise as the entire United States in 1790. It has representative government that would be fine for a federation in many ways, but maybe not for real democratic action, if that's what we really want to do, right? If we want to have the voice of the people. But regardless, or maybe for real representative government. Now, some states have that. I mean, look, for all the things I say about New England, they have some areas in New England where you have real representative government, and they've got it down to where your representative ratio is just a few thousand to one in some of their legislatures. So it's pretty nice. That's not the case, of course, in most of the states of the United States, the worst being California, where you have really no representative government at all, whether it's at the federal level or at the state level. I mean, it just doesn't work. So that needs to all be cleaned up. I mean, there's so many things to look at in terms of representative government in America. We just don't really have it in a way that's effective in many places of the United States. But regardless, this issue of decentralization is something that needs to be discussed, and we need to get things right. Look, Jamel Bowie, I called him a midwit. He is in many ways. He's right about some things. He gets other things really wrong, and he tries to come off as many other journalists do as really smart because they cite a few books, but they don't really understand the U.S. Constitution, They don't really understand originalism. They don't understand any of it. They don't understand that part of things. So let me get into this piece. And I said that the headline is actually 100% correct. It says this: "No, Nikki Haley, the Constitution does not say that." This is true. This is true. Okay. So again, I want to get into this. Bowie says, "If nothing else, it is historically fitting that a former governor of South Carolina would endorse the notion that a state can leave the American Union of its own accord." Well, it can. It can. And I'll talk about why. I've said it before. If you listen to the show, you're going to get the same thing. But it's important to keep hammering this home. During an interview on Wednesday on The Breakfast Club, a morning radio show, Nikki Haley affirmed a state's right to secede in the context of the current standoff between Governor Greg Abbott of Texas and the Federal Border Patrol. Quote, "If the whole state says we don't want to be part of America anymore, I mean, that's their decision to make," Haley said. "Let's talk about what's reality," she added. "Texas isn't going to secede." Later, when asked if she really agrees with the idea that states have a right to secede, Haley said that, quote, "states have the right to make the decisions that the people want to make." None of this is new for Haley. When asked during her 2010 campaign for governor if states had the right to leave the union, she said, "Yes, I think they do. I mean, the Constitution says that." End quote. Now that's what Bowie's going to focus on, that last statement. The Constitution says that. And this is his gotcha moment. Oh, see, this is how stupid this woman is. She's saying the Constitution says a state can secede. It doesn't say that. That's the title, that's the headline of this opinion piece. So he's got her. He's going to show how smart he is. "The problem for Haley," Bowie says, "then and now, is that the Constitution does not say that." True. It doesn't say a state can secede. This is true. It doesn't have to, because of reserved powers. You see, if anybody really understood the nature of a federal republic, where you have the central authority created by the states, as it says in the Constitution, in Article 7, is a compact or constitution between the states so ratifying the same. It was created by the people of the states, if you want to get more specific. But regardless, it is the creature of the states. It is the agent of the states. And when you have that, and as James Wilson, the ardent nationalist, argued in the State House Yard speech, all powers not delegated to the center were reserved to the states, right? This is the states could do anything. Their powers were unlimited and undefined, except insofar as what their own state constitutions do or what's prohibited in Article 1, Section 10. But there is also a caveat to Article 1, Section 10. The states can do these things if they get approval from Congress on some of those items. You see, if they can do them, then that means they could do them before. But you'd have to have the agreement of Congress, which is the body of the state, saying, yeah, these states can, a state could do this because it needs to, for whatever reason, right? So it doesn't mean they gave up all those powers. Those powers are still there. But they would have to have the union say yes, because this would be beneficial for the union at that point. That means that the states had those powers to begin with. They didn't give them up. They still retained them. But nevertheless, this is reserved powers. So a state, the Constitution doesn't have to say that a state can secede. It doesn't need to, because it's a reserved power, meaning that, it, as the 10th Amendment clearly states, all powers not delegated to the government by the Constitution, the central authority by the Constitution, are reserved to the states of the people. No prohibited, which secession, by the way, is not prohibited either. It's not prohibited by the Constitution, is it? I mean, I see nothing in there that says it's prohibited. All powers not delegated to the government by the Constitution, to the center, to the federal government by the Constitution, nor prohibited by to the states, are reserved to the states and the people, respectively, right? So I'm paraphrasing the 10th Amendment, but This is what you have. And if there is a right to secede, as a previous generation of South Carolinians learned the hard way, you won't find it in our founding documents. You don't need to. I mean, look, George Washington thought states could secede. Edmund Randolph thought states could secede. Oliver Ellsworth of Connecticut thought states could secede. Rufus King of New York or New England thought states could secede. Governor Morris of New York thought states could secede. They thought states could secede. I mean, Morris stands up in the Philadelphia Convention and says this, hey, look, if we're really so different, let's just separate now and not worry about it. Let's not put this thing together. Let's just get out. Ooh, what does that mean? What's that word? It's secession. Yes. See. But that Jamel Bowie doesn't think so. Because he says this, secession like its cousin nullification. Two different things. There's no cousin there. Secession is one thing, nullification is another. This is where Jamel Bowie's a midwit. He sounds smart, but he really doesn't understand anything. Secession is not the cousin of nullification in any way. Nullification is an action to preserve the Union. Secession is you're out. Nullification is an act of union. It's to say, we like the union, and we want to be in the union, but the union can't do X, Y, or Z, so we're going to block that. Secession is saying, we don't want to be part of you anymore. We're out. Two entirely different things. Two entirely different things. There's no cousin. Not even closely related. Now, you could say, well, wait a second, McClanahan, all these states that said they could nullify, and then if the nullification wouldn't work, then they would be out of the union. Well, think about that logically then. If you're saying that nullification doesn't work and then we're out of the union, that would mean they're two entirely different things. Yes, you're trying to ensure through nullification that the center does not abuse power, and so if it keeps abusing power, then you leave, but that's two different things. You're trying to stay in the union in the one. It's like saying, you want to know something? Marriage counseling is the same as divorce. Would anybody say that? You go to counseling so that you can preserve the union. Divorce is saying we're done. Now, I guess you could say, well, both are recognizing there's a problem. And that's true. Maybe there is a problem. Maybe the union. I mean, by default, you would say, well, there's a problem with this union, right? I mean, there's something going on here. We got to fix something. If one you're saying, we're just not even going to try, and the other one you're saying, we're trying to fix it, right? We're working on it. How are they cousins? Unless it's, there's a problem, and they're trying to address the problem. You see? They're two entirely different. Calhoun pointed this out. And yesterday, of course, we talked about how there are some midwits that think GOP is a party of Calhoun. Calhoun was trying to save the Union. That's what he did his entire political career. He was not a secessionist. This is why the secessionists in South Carolina didn't trust him. That's one thing that people don't realize. Only agreed with secession as a complete last resort if we couldn't work on this within the Union. Right. So this is a stupid point. It really is a stupid point. Of course, secession, like its cousin nullification, rests on a mistaken conception of the American Union. False. Jamel Bowie has a mistaken conception of American Union, and that's a unitary state. His mistaken conception is built on a Lincolnian position of centralization of power, which Lincoln invented when he became president. Anytime you see people argue, well, Abraham Lincoln said this. Once you say that, you have just admitted you have no idea about the American Union. Because Lincoln didn't. Just because he was president didn't mean he understood it. You see. Bowie says, you see in the opening lines of Governor Abbott's news release rejecting the Supreme Court's ruling that he could not keep federal agents from removing razor wire placed at the border with Mexico. The federal government has broken the compact between the United States and the states, Abbott wrote last week. Now, I've already talked about how Abbott doesn't even understand this stuff. I mean, that's a stupid line, too. The executive branch of the United States has a constitutional duty to enforce federal laws protecting states, including immigration laws on the books right now. That's true. That's true. So he's saying, you see it, in the opening lines of Abbott. But again, the federal government has broken the compact between the United States and the states. It's not a compact between the United States and the states. The United States is not a party to the compact. It's clear in the document itself. The compact is between the states that created the central government. That's the compact, not between the United States and the states. There's no compact between the center, which was created by the states, and the states themselves. It's not a compact. Bowie says, this is not new ground either. The compact theory of the American Union dates back to the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions of 1798, issued in defiance of the Alien Sedition Acts. But that's not where it originated, by the way. The compact fact actually originates when the Constitution was ratified in 1788, and of course, when it was drafted in 1787 because of Article 7 of the Constitution itself. It's a Constitution between the states, so ratifying the same. Which means it's a compact fact of... We have states, right? It's a compact fact. Compact between states. Oh, we could even go back before that to the Articles of Confederation. Because... in their mind, they're creating a more perfect union. A more perfect union. A union of what? Well, a union of states, as they outlined in the Articles of Confederation. The union had not changed. It was a union of states. A compact between states, as each state was sovereign and independent. That was in the Articles of Confederation. The 10th Amendment was there to say the exact same thing. To insist it. In fact, when many states issued their proposed Bill of Rights, that was number one. A 10th Amendment was the first. Madison's kicked it down to the bottom because Madison was a nationalist. But it was first, you see. Drafted in secret by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, the resolutions made two major claims. First, that the Constitution was written as a compact between the states. And second, the federal government had overstepped its bounds and was now in violation of the compact. Well, that is true. The Constitution was written as a compact between the states. I think Madison would know something about it. I mean, after all, he's called the father of the Constitution, even though, as I just said, Madison was more of a nationalist. But I think he would know what the Constitution... I mean, think about the hubris here. Well, this is incorrect. Jamel Bowie, me, I say it's incorrect. James Madison is wrong because I'm smarter than James Madison, even though James Madison was there in Philadelphia and was the father of the Constitution. But I know better because I'm Jamel Bowie. Actually, you know who knows more than this? Stanley Elkins and Eric McKittrick. They know more. They asserted, Stanley Elkins and Eric McKittrick wrote in The Age of Federalism, quote, that the Constitution to which the contracting states had assented delegated certain powers of the federal government, specifically enumerated, all others not so delegated being reserved to the states. That's true! You know who said that? James Wilson in the State House Yard speech. It's so funny. All this is true. That an case of a deliberate, palpable, and dangerous exercise of other powers not granted by the said compact, the states are in duty bound to interpose for arresting the progress of the evil. That's the Virginia Resolutions. In fact, that's Madison's much softer Virginia Resolutions. Jefferson was harder. Madison was softer. That's the softer enunciation of what they think the Constitution is. And that with the Alien and Sedition Acts, the federal government had exercised a power not only undelegated, but expressly and positively forbidden in the First Amendment. True. I mean, all that is true. There's no debate about this. Even people that are centralizers would say, yeah, I mean, maybe they didn't really have the power to do that. All this is true. It's too much to say that the resolutions made a splash. So he's saying, well, these things might have come out and they didn't really do much of anything. False. There's been an entire book written on this now about how much of an impact they actually had and how other states were starting to arm themselves in support of Virginia and Kentucky. There's a lot of evidence out there about this. But Bowie's never read that. Why? Because Bowie doesn't really know much. But yet he comes off as very intelligent guy, writing for the New York Times. All right. Now, again, I've given Bowie credit on some things that I've presented. I like to talk about Jamel Bowie because he at least writes thought-provoking pieces that are good podcast fodder. So does Adam Sewer, but I know it's Sewer, but I call him Adam Sewer because his stuff is really bad. It stinks. Just like Bowie's stuff oftentimes stinks. The immediate impact of any was to strengthen partisan feeling among the opponents of John Adams and the Federalists. Well, that's also true. I mean, why did they write these things, though? Because they wanted to control the elections. They wanted to make it to where they had no opposition. This is a false statement. None of the other state legislatures took the invitation to issue a concurrence. It's a false statement. Because they were starting to arm themselves in support of Virginia and Kentucky, if they were going to be abused by the central authority. Again, there's been some real work done on this now. And what the common nationalist knee-jerk reaction to this, nobody cared about this thing, nobody really paid attention to it. That's all untrue. Still, the compact theory of the United States would enter the lexicon of constitutional politics to emerge again more powerfully during antebellum battles over slavery and federal power. Now, notice what Bowie does here, which is really interesting. He skips over a whole bunch of history that would show that there are other people, New Englanders, for example, not just about slavery, but about other things that wanted to use the compact fact of the Constitution to their advantage. He skips over all of it. He says, which is to say that the nature of the Union remained a live question in 18... That's true. I mean, that's a true statement. So this is what Bowie does very well. He makes true statements and then tries to reason that his position is stronger, which is always incorrect. In 1813, citing compact fact, not compact theory, the Virginia Supreme Court challenged the right of the U.S. Supreme Court to hear cases on federal law originating in state court. That's also true. This led to, and he cites Martin versus Hunter's Lessee, which is an important case. He doesn't get into Cohen's v. Virginia, which, and he doesn't even give the arguments. He just says, well, they're citing compact theory. That's not what they were challenging. They're challenging the Judiciary Act of 1789. Specifically, the part of the Judiciary Act that allowed state court decisions to be appealed to federal court. And why would they do this? It wasn't really the compact theory that they were advocating. It was the fact that they were pointing out we have state courts which are equal courts to the federal courts. We don't have inferior state courts. We have state courts and we have federal courts, and the state courts are of equal status. I bet you Jamel Bowie would think that when it came to Colorado and Trump or Hawaii and the Second Amendment. He'd probably say the same thing. But no. Only when it suits his needs, you see. In 1816, the Supreme Court replied with its opinion in Martin versus Hunter's Lessee, in which Justice Joseph Story, one of the great scoundrels in American history, established the court's power of judicial review over state decisions and rejected compact theory. And of course, what does he do? He cites part of that decision, which is complete garbage. Quote, the Constitution of the United States was not ordained and established, not by the states in their sovereign capacity, but emphatically, as the preamble of the Constitution declares, by the people of the United States. It's such garbage. Everyone knows. Joseph Story, of course, was not there. He wasn't part of all this, but everyone knows and everyone knew that he's ignoring Article 7. Of course, Joseph Story was taken to task by Abel Upchur, quite effectively, by the way. And there were others that were saying these things before this. I mean, St. George Tucker, John Taylor of Caroline. Virginia was pointing out that, well, we actually have a compact. And then, of course, he's going to cite McCulloch v. Maryland. Because you see, anytime, oh, we have Joseph Story saying this, and we got John Marshall saying this, I can point out all these other people that said these things just because of their office. They somehow know more because, I mean, Spencer Rowan, who was the Chief Justice of the Virginia Supreme Court, said something entirely different. Well, because he's not in a federal court. He's not on the federal bench. Well, his opinion's not as important. He would have been if John Adams, after the election was over, I mean, a colleague of mine pointed this out in a conference I just attended. Hey, look, we want to get on Trump for when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, and then, you know, getting a justice on the bench in a way, oh, we can't do that. We shouldn't have done this. We shouldn't have done this. We should have waited for the election, and then we should have decided. You know what happened in 1800? John Adams loses. He loses the election. He's out. He's not going to be president. He's either going to be Aaron Burr or Thomas Jefferson. The dope still puts somebody on the federal bench anyways. He still appoints John Marshall, even though he's out and the Senate confirms him. And this is probably seen as okay. But the Democrats are up and, oh, well, you can't do that. You can't do this. Oh, well, John Marshall, oh, yeah, well, that's fine because, you know, he's one of us. But I'm saying, just because these people are on the bench doesn't mean that they're the gods from on high, on high's, you know, SCOTUS, who can come down and they're the most knowledgeable people on this particular thing. I mean, you listen to them sometimes in their oral arguments, or at least read it. You can tell they don't really know much what they're talking about when it comes to history in particular. I mean, yeah, look, these people, they sound, oh, what about this decision? What about that court decision? What about this? And we have this, and we have this procedure, and these things. That all sounds great. But they don't know a whole lot of history. You can tell it when they start opening their mouths. They're not very well educated on this stuff. It's quite simple. I mean, when Clarence Thomas says, well, I've been reading James McPherson and Eric Foner and these people. Well, then you're reading the wrong people. And this is the thing, right? What about John Taylor of Caroline, St. George Chuck? I mean, if you're in a legal situation, why don't you say, well, I've been reading St. George Tucker or Spencer Rowan. These are other legal theorists who are, I mean, they're judges or law professors. Don't talk about them. 3 years later, McCulloch v. Maryland, Chief Justice John Marshall bolsters Story's attack on compact theory with his own. Yes, he wrote the Constitution was ratified by the people in state conventions, but he asked, where else should they have assembled? No political dreamer was ever wild enough to think of breaking down the lines which separate the states and of compounding the American people to one common mass. You see, John, the states were the ones that sent agents to the federal convention. The states were the ones, it was signed and voted on by state. You see, if you look at then the document, in the Philadelphia Convention, that thing that you didn't attend, by the way, that thing there where it's states voting up or down on these things, not individuals, but states. And then it's a compact between the states. It's Article 7. That whole thing, John, yeah, that whole thing that's inconvenient for you, but proves that it's a compact between the states. Just because John Marshall says this, and I've gotten to this in so many different places, doesn't mean that John Marshall knows what the hell he's talking about. And he's doing it for a reason, because John Marshall didn't want guillotines. He didn't want French revolutionary Jacobins rolling around the Virginia countryside to lop off his head. That's what his problem was. When the people act, he continued, they act in their states, but the measures they adopt do not, on that account, cease to be the measures of the people themselves or become the measures of the state governments. The government, Marshall said, proceeds directly from the people. And while the assent of the states and their sovereign capacities implied in calling convention, the people themselves were also at perfect liberty to accept or reject the Constitution, and their act was final. In convention of the states. It wasn't a national convention. You didn't have a national plebiscite. You could have had, if we only got 8 states to ratify it, it wasn't ratified then, right? We didn't have a constitution. What am I missing, John? You could have had New York, Massachusetts, Virginia, Pennsylvania, right? And then take your pick of one other larger state. I don't know, let's say it was Connecticut. I mean, not a large state, but we could have one state. It could have been North Carolina. Let's just say it's Virginia, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, New York, Massachusetts. What happens if those 5 states said, "Now we're not doing this thing"? Now you can say, well, that's the majority of people in those states. Or what happens if you had small states? What happens if Delaware, Rhode Island, Georgia, Connecticut, and New Hampshire? What happens if those 5 states said, "We're not ratifying this thing"? With a really small population, would the Constitution then be in effect? No. The 5 smallest states could have gotten together and said, "Yeah, we're not doing this thing." New Jersey could have been part of that. Whatever. Maryland. You could have had 5 small states. What would have happened? We would not have a Constitution. The people would have not spoken. I mean, the majority of the people might have wanted it. The people, the majority of the people. But then 5 states would have said, "Nah, we're not doing this. We block it." Could happen that way because it's a compact between the states, you see, not of the people. Marshall's opinion was clear and persuasive. How about stupid and more stupid? But it didn't settle the issue. Compact theory reared its head again during congressional debates over the controversial tariff of 1828, condemned as the tariff of abominations by its southern opponents. It actually was there before this, there, Jamel, because, you know, in 1794, you had Northerners Oliver Ellsworth and Rufus King talking about secession. Or how about in 1801, when you had various members of the Essex Junto talking about secession? Or what about 1803, same people? Or how about 1815 in New England? Skip over that. It doesn't work for your argument. It's just about Southern slavery. Southerners trying to leave this union. At least your colleague Richard Kreitner, or at least your comrade in leftist arms, is honest about these things. You read his book, Break It Up. He says, you know, I mean, this thing really wasn't settled, even though Jamel Bowie thinks it is. He's saying, it really wasn't. I mean, it's not settled. And a lot of lefties wanted this stuff too. Compact there. Defending the tariff in a speech on the Senate floor in 1830, Daniel Webster took aim at Senator Robert Hayne of South Carolina, who held that the government was essentially one of the states, not people. No, Webster said, it's the people's constitution, the people's government, made for the people, by the people, and answerable to the people. The states, while sovereign in their own spheres, are not yet sovereign of the people. What's really funny is Daniel Webster in 1812 was making a speech that was calling for nullification and secession, by the way. But of course, I bet you Jamel Bowie doesn't even know that. Which is hilarious. Because now Daniel Webster said, we've got a government of people. We don't have a government of states. Oh, whoops. Just 18 years before this, I'm saying we have a government of states, and the states can just reject whatever the central authority does that they don't like. In 1832, after the passage of another protective tariff, the conflict over states' rights and economic policy exploded into full crisis over the doctrine of nullification. After South Carolina deemed the tariffs unconstitutional and thus void within its borders, the most radical proponents of nullification even argued that congressional failure to reform or repeal the tariffs would justify secession and the dissolution of the Union. Well, at least South Carolina would be out. President Andrew Jackson, who otherwise held states' rights in high regard, was not amused. Not only did he reject nullification, he said, quote, perpetuity is stamped upon the Constitution by the blood of our fathers, by those who achieved as well as those who improved our system of free government. This isn't an argument. It's an emotional appeal. That's not an argument. Think about what he says. Perpetuity is stamped upon the Constitution by the blood of our fathers. That's not an argument. That's saying, you know what? Our fathers died for this. So therefore, it's perpetual. That's not a legal argument. That's just an emotional appeal. That's all that is. That's emotivism, not an argument. For this purpose was the principle of amendment inserted in the Constitution, which all have sworn to support, and in violation of which no state or states have the right to dissolve the Union. Sure they do. The states can dissolve the union. They can call a convention. They could have an amendment that dissolves the union, if you want to say there's that, but they can dissolve the union. States can do whatever they want. The union does not exist independently of the states. It's their creature. They can get rid of it if they want to. From Story to Jackson, we get the component parts of Abraham Lincoln's argument against secession, which, of course, is ridiculous, which came in the wake of Jefferson Davis' declaration as a newly elected president of the Confederate States of America that when the compact of the Union had been perverted from the purposes for which it was ordained, the government created by that compact should cease to exist. This, said Lincoln in his first inaugural address, is wrong. The unity of these states is perpetually said, perpetuity is implied, if not expressed, in the fundamental law of all national governments. It is safe to assert that no government proper ever had a provision in its organic law for its own termination. Well, the Articles of Confederation were perpetual, were they not? And yet, that thing seemed to go away. But it was supposed to be perpetual. That union was supposed to be perpetual just like that, and then it went away. Lincoln would later elaborate on this view in a message to Congress on July 4th, 1861. By the way, if you want to get all this, I cover all this stuff in McClanahan Academy. Reading Abraham Lincoln, reading Jefferson Davis, I go through all these things, reading secession. If you had taken my classes, you'd already known all this stuff. I mean, it's right there. You're going to be able to pick through these articles and say, that's stupid, that's stupid, that's stupid, that's ridiculous. Nope, no, that's dumb. I'm telling you, you got it all. The states have their status in the Union. They have no other legal status. That they break from this, they can only do so against law and by revolution, he wrote. The Union, not themselves, separately procured their independence and their liberty. The Union procured their independence. The Union did that. What's curious, because, of course, that's not what the British said. Even this next argument, of course, there's a new book out. Paul Graham has a book. And of course, we get into this too in the 1607 Project, which is forthcoming. But Paul Graham, Nonsense on Stilts, The Gettysburg Address and Lincoln's Imaginary Nation. Great book. I pick it up. Of course, so many things written on this, but that's news, so get it. 1607 Project is going to talk about this too. This is where it gets really funny. The Union is older than any of the states, and in fact, it created them as states. False. Originally, some dependent colonies made the Union, and in turn, the Union threw off their old independence for them and made the states such as they are. Weird. That's a weird argument. The Union made the states. I mean, think about that argument. It's completely stupid. It doesn't even work. If that was the case, then how could the Kingdom of Great Britain and the King recognize each state independently, as Paul Graham actually has an appendix in his book where has the Treaty of Paris in there. It's amazing when you read that thing. Oh, wait a second here. Lincoln's just full of garbage. The subsequent 4 years of bloodshed would settle the question. No, it wouldn't. No, it wouldn't. Even modern legal scholars are starting to say, yeah, it really didn't settle the question. The United States was, as Lincoln declared, an echo of Webster, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. The Union was forever, and no state or states on their own could decide otherwise. False. So what he's done here is made an argument for Joseph Story, John Marshall, Daniel Webster, Abraham Lincoln. That is the final say on this. But it's not really, because it was the war and simply the other side got bludgeoned. But that's not really settling the argument, is it? Because they didn't really make a strong legal case. Oh, I forgot Andrew Jackson in there. But you notice it's why all these things. I also have a reading Andrew Jackson class, reading Radical Republicans. I get through all these people. Maybe I'll go reading the Whigs or something and get into, you know, Daniel Webster and others. In other words, Nikki Haley is wrong, as is anyone else who treats secession and nullification as legitimate features of the American Constitution. No, in fact, they're right. And Jamel Bowie, you're wrong. Because you don't know much. This is why I called you a midwit. Now, I've actually asked Jamel Bowie to come on with me and defend his positions, and he won't even respond to me. And I've been very, you know, except for today, I'm usually pretty soft on Bowie, but today, I mean, this is just ridiculously stupid. It's midwittery at its finest. Greg Abbott is also wrong. The United States is not a compact. False. It is. You know who else says this? Noah Feldman. the progressive legal scholar who's come out and said, yeah, all these people that call it a compact, they're actually right. They're actually right. But you know what we have? The 14th Amendment. You see, what Bowie is trying to do is argue from the antebellum position, and all that is wrong. If you argue from the 14th Amendment position, maybe he has an argument. Maybe he has a case that after the war is over, we get a transformation of government. Maybe. I would even argue with that. But it's a stronger position than saying all these people in the original, it's all wrong. It's not a compact. False. It was. The record is clear. Lincoln was making this stuff up as he went. So was Webster. So was Marshall. So was Story. In fact, Joseph Story argues his positions based on the arguments against the Constitution. You see? That's important. This may seem academic, but it isn't. Behind the notion that the states are independent and sovereign is the idea that what happens within the borders of Ohio or Texas or Florida is of no concern to those within the borders of New York or California or Rhode Island. You see, this is what it comes down to. You know what the problem is? These people in these states think they can do what they want. And me and where I live, I can tell them what to do. That's what the problem is. The problem is I can't tell these people what to do. This is the puritanical nature of American politics. I'm going to tell you what to do. It's the notion that it should be the right of a state to do as it pleases. The people of that state, yes. If Oklahoma wants to regulate the bodies of its residents, then it's the business of Oklahoma. You know who said that? The founding generation. Over and over and over again. That was the whole basis of the Union. Jamal Bowie doesn't think so. Because Jamal Bowie doesn't really know much. To think of the United States as a single country formed by a single people is to suggest, by contrast, that we share some sets of rights and responsibilities, privileges and obligations. That as diverse and fractured as we are, what happens to one part of us affects the whole. False. If what happens in California affects me, that's really strange, because unless they're going to come in and legislate for where I live, that's not going to happen. The fact that you have tent cities all around LA and San Francisco and other places, and you have to have, you know, apps to show you where people don't defecate on the streets in San Francisco, that really doesn't affect me. Doesn't affect the whole at all. Just affects the dopes who live with it in California. The states are just lines on a map. False. What matters is that we share this country, and as such, we owe one another our attention, our care, and our due regard. Well, I've duly regarded your piece, and it's stupid. Anyways, had to get through this. It's just so bad. I know it went a little long, but Jamal Bowie, this is one of the worst pieces he's ever written because it's just complete garbage. It's complete midwittery, and it really has no understanding of the original compact. See you next time on the Brian McClanahan Show. See you then.